Welcome back, everyone, to what promises to be a momentous day in American political history. I'm sort of being sarcastic because right now we have Michael Cohen, who is testifying before Congress. It is extremely important for a number of different reasons, but it's not an ideal situation, J.R. Jackson. I'm sure you would agree, because he has major issues with his credibility that we will, of course, discuss. That's the big story of the day. We're very glad to have you on the show, J.R.
Well, if we talk about credibility, we're going to get into this in more depth, but credibility based off of what he has lied about and who he has lied for. So the specifics of that diminished credibility isn't always fleshed out completely.
Yeah. So we're gonna break it down a little bit more, but we've got a lot of other news that we want to talk about as well. A couple of different scandals involving sexual assault in the news. We're gonna be talking about shocking new revelations of acts of sexual assault and abuse against migrant children at a number of different government like resettlement areas, as well as Donald Trump facing just the latest in a long string of accusations of sexual assault, this time from one of his former staffers. We also have a couple of interviews that are gonna be coming up. We are really hoping to connect with the director of an Oscar-nominated short documentary from the Oscars that just happened, A Night at the Garden, which is a fascinating look at American Nazism. 80 years ago, it is just amazing. So we're hoping to talk to him. And we also have John Bonifaz is gonna be coming back on the show a little bit later on to talk once again about the possibility of Donald Trump being impeached and one of the newest rationales for that that Donald Trump himself has been promoting. So all that and more to talk about, we're gonna jump into Michael Cohen. At the time that we are filming this, Michael Cohen has been testifying before Congress for several hours now. And we have particular things that he said that we want to dive into. But first, I wanna talk a little bit about his strategy and the strategies of the Democrats and the Republicans, who seem to be sort of unified. Democrats are all asking similar sorts of questions. Republicans are all doing the same sort of thing, barely even asking questions. But I will say that overall, I think that Michael Cohen, in the areas where he is attempting to convince you that he is so sorry for all the things that he's done, maybe that plays well with regular people, and maybe that's the point. It's a sort of pragmatic thing where he knows that his credibility is an issue, and so he wants to reassure you that he is, he does regret what he did. I don't like that stuff. I'm very interested in what Michael Cohen has to say, and more importantly, what he is able to prove. But I'm not changing my opinion about fundamentally who he is and who he has
been. Right, that's what I'm wondering. You don't like that stuff as far as his mea culpas. You
don't like, buy it.
Yeah, is it because you don't buy it or because you don't think it's necessary?
Both. I don't buy it. I don't think it's necessary, and I don't care. Okay. He will and should go to jail for what he has done. I would be perfectly happy if when he leaves jail, he recedes like the elves in Middle Earth to another place. Granted, they went to the good spot. He probably wouldn't do that. But he can go off into the shadows and just live the rest of his life. Probably will happen. He'll probably write a book and he'll probably do quite fine. I look forward to Ben Affleck playing him in the movie. But I don't need to hear from him once we know what he knows and what he can prove.
And that's what I was wondering because I feel like I'm the cold-hearted one who always thinks someone's apology, especially in these types of cases, from someone so far up and so connected to people who've done horrible things their whole entire lives, I don't care if he's sorry.
Mm-hmm.
So the decision of whether or not he's going to be his apology or if he actually feels bad about the things he's done, it doesn't matter to me at all. Because if he's sincere, I don't care.
Yeah.
If he's not, I don't care. Give us some facts. That's why I was frustrated by sometimes the line of question that it asks things that aren't based in the facts. It's like, so how do you feel about this? What do you think could have possibly happened? I don't care. Yeah. I don't care what he thinks or possibly could have happened. I want him to tell us what happened and give us some concrete evidence as to how that happened.
And look, he started off saying, I understand that I have a credibility issue. That is why I am bringing documentation.
Absolutely.
So I can show you the letters where we threatened schools to not release his transcript, which we'll talk about a little bit later on. I can show you the checks and who signed them to pay off mistresses who alleged that they had affairs with him. To his credibility, his sincerity, I'm not that interested. But I do want to talk about the Republicans because they are definitely not sincere. By the way, I can see that AOC is now visible on it. And if I miss her questions, I'm going to be very angry. But the Republican strategy from the very beginning, from before Michael Cohen actually sat down with Jim Jordan, who should be facing his own congressional inquiry.
Absolutely.
And definitely decided not to wear a suit jacket to this to show how little he cares for it. I don't think that I didn't notice that, Jim. So they have been aggressively attacking Michael Cohen. And what I think is so fascinating is they are definitely, they see themselves as defenders of the president. They are there to defend him. And yet, the sort of defense they're doing is just an attack against Michael Cohen. I have yet to see, maybe I missed it, I've yet to see a single Republican seriously try to put forward the idea that perhaps Donald Trump did not commit any crimes.
Right.
They seem to take it as a given that obviously he committed crimes. I'm not going to try to convince you that that's not true. Let me see if I can also torpedo Michael Cohen as a distraction from that truth.
It's always, it's a constant thing. And it goes from Cohen to Lanny Davis, I believe, yeah, his attorney. Who did he work for before? Whose connections has he had? How much is he getting paid? Who's paying him? Do you want a book deal? Do you want a TV deal? What is he going to do next? How do you make money? Who got you here? Mm-hmm. How much does that suit cost? So it, all these things that surround this whole breaking down his credibility in that moment, in this hearing right now. So the people that want to hear that stuff already don't have any faith in Michael Cohen and anything he's going to say. But somehow still have faith in the guy that he lied for. Still trying to figure out how that works out. How two bank robbers go into a bank, rob it for $1 million, come out, one of them gets caught and says, hey, this is what happened. You go, hey, how am I going to trust you? You're just the bank robber that we caught with the other bank robber that we saw on camera doing things together.
Yeah, why did Donald Trump continue to keep him in his employ for year after year after year after year that he was a gigantic lying criminal, as you say that he was? That doesn't reflect at all on Donald Trump?
It's telling when you don't want to actually get to the facts or dispel the things that were put forward.
Yeah.
When he shows you an image of a check with $36,000, $35,000 written in it with a signature, there's no question of saying, hey, we're going to compare Donald Trump's signature on all these documents that he signs, executive orders and things, and compare it to that check and see how different it is, because this is a lie. That's why you're not credible. None of that happened.
Or even engaging in, why is it that the president was paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to silence women? They don't care, and they can't even put forward a sort of counter narrative to why they are not talking about it. But I want to turn to one of the particular things that came up. In his opening statements, Michael Cohen talked about a number of different things, which we'll discuss. One had to do with him going and telling lies about the state of negotiations with real estate authorities in Moscow, the possibility of building property there. And here is what he said.
I lied to Congress when Mr. Trump stopped negotiating the Moscow Tower project in Russia. Mr. Trump did not directly tell me to lie to Congress. That's not how he operates. In conversations we had during the campaign, at the same time I was actively negotiating in Russia for him, he would look me in the eye and tell me there's no Russian business, and then go on to lie to the American people by saying the same thing. In his way, he was telling me to lie. You need to know that Mr. Trump's personal lawyers reviewed and edited my statement to Congress about the timing of the Moscow Tower negotiations before I gave it. So to be clear, Mr. Trump knew of and directed the Trump-Moscow negotiations throughout the campaign and lied about it.
And to be clear, as with every other subject, the Republicans in that room have no interest whatsoever in actually asking follow-ups concerning that, why it is that Donald Trump would be lying about that, why we might care that he would be lying about that. The huge stakes that he had in a continuing business deal there, they're not interested in it. They don't want to find out anything.
Honestly,
about it.
What Cohen's testimony today does is it confirms what Trump has already given us in public statements already. He talked about how he continued working in Russia for this because he can do that. He said it multiple times. Once there was a layer of truth revealed of what he's been doing the whole time, he goes, I can do that. I can do that while I'm running my campaign. He admitted that he can do that, which means he did. So when Cohen comes in and confirms it with his own personal experiences with Trump, all it is it we have a confirmation of what happened now. Mm-hmm. So I think that is a source of credibility for Cohen, because he's finalizing what Trump said he's already done. It's not like this is the first time we've heard this.
Yeah.
None of this is new.
Yeah,
it's just confirmation.
Yeah, and just to double down on what you said, at least from the point of view of Donald Trump, there was nothing illicit in having those negotiations, which means that he didn't lie because he had to. He lies because he chose to, thus begging the question, why did he choose to lie about that? Why conceal those particular business dealings when he is so happy 99.9% of the time to trumpet all of the great successes he's having internationally in terms of his business? He doesn't mind talking about them in every other situation, but in this one, it was all very hush-hush. We will be watching, of course, to see if either the Republicans or the Democrats are able to shed more light on that. The Republicans obviously don't seem interested in it. And the Democrats, at least as of us doing this taping right now, seem unable to actually elicit any new information from Michael Cohen, but we'll be watching. We are going to take a short break. Stick around, lots more to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Scariest things about the rise of modern day extremist movements like white supremacists, the Nazi movement in the US and in parts of Europe are the ways that it's reflected in what has come before. And joining us now to talk about this, a director of a fascinating documentary, A Night at the Garden, multiple Oscar nominee, Marshall Curry. Welcome to the show.
Thanks so much.
To have you here. I found your documentary, A Night at the Garden, absolutely fascinating. And so for those who might not have seen it yet, could you describe this project and what it is that your documentary reveals?
Sure. So 80 years ago this month, 20,000 Americans gathered in Madison Square Garden for a Nazi rally. And the room was surreal. It was full of American flags. The rally outside was billed as a pro-America rally. There's a huge 30-foot portrait of George Washington. But inside, George Washington is flanked on either side with swastikas. And when the speaker takes the stage, he begins by attacking the press for lying about him. Then he attacks Jews, minorities, immigrants. And a protester runs out on stage and is beaten up. The whole film is only 7 minutes long. It's made entirely of archival footage that we found.
And I want to return to how you assemble this film in just a second. But I do want to say that when you see that image of the backdrop to the stage, the massive George Washington with the swastikas, I mean, it definitely feels like Handmaid's Tale or another one of these sorts of like looks back at that time, you know, through the lens of modern parody and all of that.
Man in the High Castle.
Man in the High Castle, exactly. Like it. If I were to attempt to write this, I could not have come up with better imagery than you were able to find. So how exactly do you go about tracking down original video of this event that the vast majority of Americans have no memory of even happening?
Well, it is weird that we don't know it. It seems like this footage should be part of every high schooler's lessons about World War II and the Holocaust. But I was at dinner one night with a friend who was writing a screenplay that takes place in 1939. And he told me about the rally, and I actually didn't believe him. I thought, surely, if this existed, I would know about it. But I went home and started doing some research, and I discovered that not only was it real, but there were some 5-second video clips, 10-second clips in historical documentaries. And so I knew that if there were 10 seconds, there had to be a lot more than that. Mm-hmm. And so I got an archival researcher who was a friend to start looking around, and some of it he found in the National Archive. Some of it was in UCLA's archive, Grinberg Archive. There were a number of places that had pieces of footage from that night, but nobody had ever gathered it together. And even the National Archive had film that had never been scanned high definition before. Yeah. So. But we gathered it all, and when I saw it, I was
so I'm very curious. As you're assembling this and you're cutting down the video that you have, What sort of feelings are you hoping or expecting to evoke in the audience? And to what extent is what you're revealing in this documentary either intended, either purposefully or even accidentally, to reflect some modern political developments?
Well, when I saw it, it was clear to me that there was a relevance to today. I mean, like 1939, right now there are demagogues that are taking power all over the world, who are taking power by using the same tactics that we see in this footage. We see people attack the press, scapegoat minorities, scapegoat immigrants, and beat up protesters. And that felt like it was important for Americans and people around the world to see what happened when demagogues did this in 1939, so that maybe they would be a little more wary and a little more vigilant when they see people using these same tactics today.
In a bit of the B-roll that we just showed there, what you were talking about, the protester who has actually attacked, that sort of rushed the stage there, that's one of the high or low points, depending on how you look at it, of the documentary. And I found it amazing that not only is he immediately swarmed and being brutally beaten, but you have a shot where in the background there's a number of the children, and one child is sort of marching in place and smiling and laughing to himself, which is obviously a horrifying juxtaposition. And I'm curious, that protester who was attacked, I mean, do we know anything about this person and their story? What ended up happening to them? Is any of that known?
We do. So his name was Isidore Greenbaum. He was a Jewish plumber's assistant from Brooklyn. And he went to the rally that night sort of on a whim, not knowing really what it was going to, what he was going to see, and was so shocked and outraged by what he saw that he felt like he needed to run out and confront what was happening. We've been in touch actually with his grandson, who is understandably very proud of his grandfather's bravery and taking on a mob of 20,000 people. But the next day, that night he was beaten up. He was arrested and was charged $25 for disturbing the peace. The next day, the newspaper articles reported that the judge told him, "Don't you realize that someone could have been hurt by what you did out on stage?" And he said, "Don't you realize that someone's going to be hurt from what was being said on that stage?" And of course, this is 1939. In the next few years, millions of Jews and others would be murdered. So he was exactly right to be speaking up at that point.
And if I remember correctly, this rally happened, I think it was 7 months before the invasion of Poland, but at the same time concurrently with the construction of concentration camps and things like that. I'm also curious, just I always like to find out more after I see a movie that affects me. Obviously, you cut this down to just about 7 minutes or so. Were this to be a feature-length documentary like some of your other work is, what else might we have seen? What else happened at that rally?
Well, you know, I'm sure a lot happened. We don't have a ton of footage, and I don't know whether all the footage that we found was the totality of what was shot that night, or whether there is a lot more that has just been sort of lost to history, either destroyed or is sitting in a basement somewhere. What I tried to do was cut down something that you know, at its bare bone would transport the audience into the event, would show them the scale and spectacle of it, would show them what people were being said, and would also show them the reaction of the crowd, which was the thing that was the most disturbing to me. You mentioned earlier that there's a shot where a little boy sort of excitedly rubs his hands and dances as he watches the protester get beaten up. The regular crowd has similar reactions. You know, you see 20,000 Americans. These are people who would be my neighbors. I live in Brooklyn. These would be, you know, people in their hats and dresses and suits, and they showed up that night to just cheer and laugh and be entertained by someone who was able to stir up their darker demons. And I think that one of the things that I wanted to show with the film was that we are susceptible as human beings, as Americans, to demagogues who can push our buttons and stir up our hatred against each other. And we shouldn't be complacent assuming that people will do the right thing. We have to be vigilant.
Yeah, because the last thing we want is for some documentarian in 80 years to create a documentary of where we're at right now, where that goes. Right. Marsha Curry, thank you so much for joining us. Night of the Garden, fascinating documentary, and congratulations as well on your nominations.
Thanks so much. And of course, if your audience wants to watch it, it's online, anightatthegarden.com or lots of other places. They can learn more about the night and they can see the full 7-minute film.
And I would certainly suggest that they do. Thank you again.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, lots more news to cover after this. On top of all of the other scandals and tragedies involving our treatment of migrants at the southern border, both recently under Donald Trump and in the years prior, we now have another absolutely horrendous information, thankfully coming out as a result of both reporters and a congressman. New government documents reveal that over 5,800 complaints of sexual abuse from unaccompanied minors were reported to the Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Justice between the years of 2014 and 2018. And again, that's just a few years of reporting there for literally thousands of these sorts of claims. And we're talking about over 1,000. One act would be a tragedy. We have 1,000 a year or more. Let's talk about the nature of those complaints. Some of the allegations include reports that adult staff members formed relationships with detained minors, showed children pornographic videos, and forcibly touched minors' genitals. Investigations into the allegations often ended in the termination of the staff member, which certainly sounds like good news that there are consequences for this. I would assume that something more than termination from your position would be warranted. And also, saying that these people are losing their jobs after they do it is less comforting when you see that year after year after year it continues to happen. And in fact, the numbers are rapidly going up in the past couple of years. So before we get into how we found out about this, some of the statements about it, I guess at all surprised?
No, this when we have people with unchecked power like this, they start doing things that they feel they can do to powerless people, you know? So when you have a system where, of course, we've given off this power to different groups, for-profit prison types of groups, to house folks that we already see as inhumane, mm-hmm. like they don't live up to it. They're all rapists, murderers, and criminals anyway. So who cares what happens to them? It's on another scale of what we do with our prisoners. Because in a prison system, like, oh, those guys are criminals. It doesn't matter what happens to them now. They commit a crime now. They deserve whatever mm-hmm. happens to them there. So this has been spread to now this section where now children, who cares what happens to them? We don't care about them. No one's going to do anything about them. The administration is already separating them from their families at a wide scale, and no one's stopping them. So what is going to stop me from doing more that I want to do to them?
Yeah.
It's when you start with a certain mindset and attitude towards certain folks, and it trickles to everyone who has any kind of power over those same people. Who cares? They're not real humans anyway.
Yeah, yeah. The adults are criminals, and the kids are trying to get one over on us. They shouldn't be here. They don't belong here. Look, I hope. That sort of position, when you're working in the actual facilities that are involved in either refugee resettlement or, you know, temporary holding before some sort of legal representative, probably attracts some people who genuinely want to help this community, I'm sure. I wish that was a very large percentage. I don't know that it is. But there are going to be people that want authority, as you say, unchecked. They want that. They want power over people. And who, both traditionally and especially recently, has both less inherent rights and respect and consideration from the authorities than unaccompanied minor children. And so you see that. So you can't be surprised that this sort of thing is happening. Now, again, this is not something that began with Donald Trump. Just this most recent set of reports stretch back to 2014. And even in 2014, the numbers are significantly lower, but they're still insanely high. But when you have as a policy that you are going to detain more and more of these children for longer and longer, you are naturally, of course, going to have more of the same sorts of systemic abuses that we saw previously. And on top of that, as a guiding philosophy for this policy, you have not any concern for the welfare of the children, but these kids are a tactic to scare other people away from coming to this country. And as long as they're being held, as long as people know that that's likely to happen to their children, then that accomplishes the deterrence that we want. It doesn't matter how they're being treated. In fact, perversely, if they're being abused and victimized, that should be scarier for parents who are considering coming. So I'm not saying that that was a sort of conscious decision on the part of the authorities, but it's kind of a side effect that certainly helps them in their mission to scare people from El Salvador and Guatemala and other countries from making that trip.
If bad things happen to people, they're like, okay, not necessarily good. That's what we planned, as you pointed out. Just like, okay, maybe they'll think twice. The rest of them aren't here yet. They'll think twice about what may happen to their kids.
So I want to give shout out to the representative Ted Deutsch who released this information during a hearing. Some quotes from him. He says, "These documents demonstrate over the past 3 years there have been 154 staff unaccompanied minor. Let me repeat that: staff unaccompanied minor allegations of sexual assault. So the harshest accusations out of this set. Together, these documents detail an environment of systemic sexual assaults by staff on unaccompanied children." And to put some more numbers to what's happened recently, since the Trump administration enacted its zero tolerance policies last year, the number of children detained put detention centers nearly at full capacity. By September of last year, almost 13,000 minors are being detained, with over 3,000 children being held in a tent city where journalists and advocates described inhumane living conditions. And if the conditions are horrendous at the permanent facilities, I would have to imagine that the standards at the hastily thrown together tent cities or concentration camps, as many people refer to them, for these children, probably don't have higher standards, if I had to guess. With that, though, there is other news of this sort. Donald Trump over the years has faced a number of different allegations of both sexual harassment and sexual assault. He has, in fact, on tape bragged about the sexual assaults that he has performed. But we've moved on, it's normalized, I guess it's not a big deal. However, there's a new allegation, this time from a woman, a former staffer of Donald Trump, who says that she was assaulted by Donald Trump during the actual campaign, which is a first from these accusers. This is Alva Johnson, who joins at least 16 other women who've reported sexual misconduct by Trump spanning decades, including several reports that directly mirror Johnson's allegations. She says that Trump grabbed her hand and leaned in to kiss her on the lips as he exited an RV outside of a rally in Tampa back in August of 2016. Johnson said she turned her head and the unwanted kiss landed on the side of her mouth. She also says that she told her boyfriend, mother, and stepfather about the allegations on the day that it occurred. All three of those confirmed that she did that to the Washington Post. And she has also said in interviews that are just beginning to be held that because she did not speak up at the time, and in fact spoke favorably of Donald Trump while pursuing positions and things like that he might have authority over, she continues to have a great deal of regret and trauma mentally over the role that she played, perhaps.
So every time,
obviously, she should not have those feelings, but she does have.
Well, these stories come out all the time when people have you know, been sexually assaulted or even worse, that they don't necessarily tell, and then the reasons behind it or why. It fits right with it. So whenever we keep dispelling the real studies and the real reasons that's given by people why victims do things like this, and then it happens in real life, which one are we, like, we don't believe the reality of the stats. We also don't believe the victim as they say what happened. What are we left to believe but only just the guy that potentially committed the assault? There's nothing left to go off of. I'm still not sure how we're making heads or tails of it. This hasn't been getting reported much at all, because now, when you add it with, now she's the 16th woman. When you add it with the other 15 women, the 17th. With the other 16 women, now suddenly it's like, oh, this just keeps happening.
Yeah.
At what point do we see the numbers and say, hey, this is really something? Or do we say, oh, the numbers are so high, it must be fake? Mm-hmm. It's just an arbitrary way to just go about it. You're willing to believe one person over the other just because of who they are and what they keep saying is happening.
And so they have a perfect defense where, and if it's just one or two women, well, then that's not a pattern. It could just be one or two psycho randos. If it gets to be 10, 15, 20, well, then it's just people coming out of the woodwork because it's a pattern. There's no point where it becomes credible to some people.
She continues to work on the campaign. It must not have actually happened. Oh, what if she quit? Oh, she's a disgruntled employee. Yeah. She must have been mad about something. There's always an excuse.
And we don't know for sure. She says that she told people contemporaneously. There are others who are continued Trump loyalists, so bear that in mind, who say that they were there and it didn't happen. We're just putting out what she is saying. Right. And I will say, to what you said about the reporting, let's jump ahead to coverage of her accusation. CNN talked about it in the initial period after it came out, 0 minutes. Fox News talked about it for slightly less than 1 minute. And MSNBC did 25 minutes. I believe more than half of that was a Chris Hayes segment on the topic. So this is an accusation of sexual assault by the sitting president when he was a candidate for president. And there's a number of different reasons this might not be reporting. I don't like any of them. One is that crimes by the president are so normalized at this point that we don't even care. Two is that we're so distracted by other scandals. Maybe it was that, you know, he said that he fell in love with the dictator of North Korea. Yeah. Maybe that distracted people. Or third, it's because unlike the vast majority of the others, she is an African-American accuser. Perhaps that's why it didn't merit any coverage.
They're
by
worried
the
about
media.
The reaction, yes, because if the reaction comes about who this now lady is, I looked at it a little bit because I was speculating what the rejections of her story would be. It was she's way too ugly, which
Donald Trump has given
heard
as
that
a,
from.
Yeah,
exactly. She's way too ugly. She was continuing to work from. Look at all the options he had. It continues on. And also, I think many of the media coverage, maybe even saying it, was worried about what the reaction would be from the White House. We saw the way CNN has hired certain folks to avoid, potentially, we don't know the full reason, but to avoid any more of the wrath from the White House about how their fake news and their continuously against the president. It works to dampen the story. So you don't talk about it because you don't want to get that pushback anymore.
Yeah, maybe they're scared. I don't like that explanation either. We are going to take a break, though, when we come back, more for you. You might have forgotten, but we're actually in the middle of a national emergency right now. It's easy to forget because we look around and we don't see any cause for the declaration that Donald Trump did not long ago. But he did it, and we now have to suffer the consequences. But perhaps he will as well. And joining us now to break down some of what those consequences might be, John Bonifaz, co-founder and president of Free Speech for People. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for joining, having me.
Very glad to have you here. So we had the declaration of a national emergency. To your mind, is this a legitimate declaration?
No, it's a bogus declaration. The president knew that he was not going to get out of Congress the funding for his wall on the southern border. He heard that twice from Congress. He shut the government down in December and then reopened it in January when he didn't get the funding for the wall. And then after his short time frame to give Congress the opportunity to negotiate and discuss how to engage in funding his wall, they refused again explicitly to fund it. And he said throughout that he would use fake emergency powers, these emergency powers, he said he would use them to build this wall if he didn't get the funding. That is precisely not what the National Emergency Powers Act of 1976 is designed for. It's not designed as an end run around Congress and their sole authority to appropriate money. So this is a clear violation of the separation of powers principles where Congress and only Congress has the power to appropriate funds. And effectively what Donald Trump is doing is seizing legislative powers by the executive, the very definition of tyranny according to James Madison, and trying to fund his wall by taking monies from the military budget that was never designed for this to build it. And this is why we have announced at freespeechforpeople.org this 11th ground for impeachment proceedings. This abuse of emergency powers, violation of the separation of powers principle gives ground for impeachment proceedings again.
So as you point out that you've described not only this but other grounds for his impeachment, you called this the 11th. I'm curious, does this break the top 10? How does this rank in comparison to other violations of the law and things like that that he has done? And also, why do you believe that impeachment is necessary at this point? Sort of the philosophical underpinning of the multiple different arguments that you and your group have been making.
Right. So there's no question this is one of the most serious impeachable offenses this president has committed. Serious because the use of emergency powers threatens our republic directly. If the president's going to declare emergency for building his wall, what else will he declare an emergency for? For sanctioning Americans, for shutting down the internet, for using the military to shut down protests in the United States? This is a very dangerous president to have access to these emergency powers when he is so lawless and so willing to defy the very essence of our Constitution. So it's a very serious impeachable offense and demands that Congress act. As far as why Congress must act, the impeachment power in the Constitution is there for Congress representing the people to protect the republic. The remedy is removal from office. This is separate and apart from any criminal investigation that Robert Mueller or the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of New York or anyone else is conducting of Donald Trump. The punishment, the remedy there, rather, is punishment in the criminal justice system. And that is distinct from the remedy here. We need to protect our republic, protect our Constitution, and to simply say we're going to wait until 2020 to so-called impeach him at the ballot is mixing apples and oranges. We need to deal with the constitutional crisis facing America today, with the emergency that's in the Oval Office today, and start impeachment proceedings now.
And I know that there are members of Congress that do support impeaching the president for a number of different reasons, including ones that you've listed. We've previously talked about the op-ed that you co-wrote with Representative Rashida Tlaib. I am curious, though, it seems like while there was a lot of talk about the possibility during the campaign and immediately after, even at the beginning of this year, I don't see as an outsider much actual progress towards that. And so I'm curious, as more of an insider in terms of this effort, do you believe that there is sort of substantive progress inside of Congress pushing for impeachment?
I think there's some, but I think you're right that there's not enough. And frankly, what it's going to take is further pressure from the outside, from we the people. Today, we announced that state legislators in Massachusetts and in Pennsylvania have introduced impeachment resolutions modeled off of resolutions we've drafted, which would call on Congress and their congressional delegations to start impeachment proceedings. We need to see more of this activity at the state and local level. We need to be calling on our members of Congress to act. And the time is now. I know many in Congress are trying to effectively hide behind the issuance of the Mueller report, whenever and if we ever see that. But that is really kicking the can down the road on this crisis that we face today. We do not need the Mueller report to start impeachment proceedings. The Mueller report may amplify the need for impeachment proceedings, but we already had more than sufficient evidence to demonstrate that this president needs to be held accountable via the impeachment process. And members of Congress need to follow their oaths, defend our Constitution, and start those impeachment proceedings now.
And I think that the distinction you draw between the what might come from the Mueller report and what we already know is an important distinction that is often lost. Because I feel like, as you point out, that members of Congress are appearing to hide behind the eventual release of it. I think much of the media is doing the same thing. So thank you for drawing that distinction. John Bonifaz, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a short break. We're going to close out the rest of the hour on the Damage Report, touching base with what's been going on in the Michael Cohen testimony while we've been broadcasting after this. Let's talk about blind loyalty and tribalism and partisanship, because Jared Jackson and I, we've been listening to the Cohen testimony during the breaks. And every one of the, look, I have issues with the Democrat questions too. They're mostly pointless. They don't reveal anything new for the most part. But the Republican questions are all just, I want to make sure that one person who's watching this, Donald Trump, knows that I have got his back and I'm defending him. And so, none of them are remotely interested in whether Donald Trump committed crimes and if he did, cares about it at all. That is the most clear thing in the universe. It is screaming from every one of them. Some of them are literally screaming, like Mark Meadows. So I want to talk just a little bit about it, because we just had one female Republican representative, one of the few, who is he's saying that she wasn't sent to Congress to do this. And as we all know, you only do in Congress the exact one reason that you went there for. But Michael Cohen talked about blind loyalty and how he operated for years with blind loyalty, saying, I'm responsible for your silliness because I did the same thing that you're doing now for 10 years, talking about what he's seeing in the Republicans in Congress, saying the more people that followed Trump blindly, as I did, the more people will suffer the consequences, as I did. And that has not dissuaded a single one of them from lining up to bow at the altar of Donald Trump.
It's the true thing. So when they say, like, I was thinking this morning, they said how much of a liar he's been for 10 years. I said, who has he been working with?
Yeah.
10 years. So if he's been lying and working for Trump, is he lying against Trump for 10 years? This is a really bad leader of a business if he keeps hiring people who are destroying him from within. So that wasn't always obviously put out there. But like you said, the line when you're saying, yes, I was being a blind loyalist and it destroyed me, be careful. No one heeds these kinds of warnings. Yeah. I don't know what it's going to take.
I don't see one bit of independent thought from the questions that have been asked. Like you could like if you're a Republican congressman, I get it. You don't want your president to be impeached, and you might be willing to turn a blind eye to criminal acts because of how damaging it would be, and you'll say, well, you know, it's in the better interest of the country, whatever. But like, at least pretend for your own legacy's sake that you have any loyalty whatsoever to the country or the American people beyond your loyalty to Donald Trump. Not everything needs to be filtered through that very particular sort of lens. But for them it is. There's nothing there. These are not a group of, you know, more than a dozen individuals. These are the same philosophy being beamed out of the mouth holes of a bunch of human husks. Where independent thought might have once dwelled, it exists no longer. And so that has made this hearing far more depressing because they won't engage seriously with the allegations that are being made. You don't have to blindly assume that what Michael Cohen is saying is true, but ask questions designed to find out if it's true or not. And they're not interested in doing that either.
There was the representative you were talking about was Representative Carol Miller out of West Virginia. She was the one that was saying, I was sent to Congress to do just this because what you're doing today in this hearing is a disgrace to the American people. Yeah. And the American people in West Virginia sent me this way to do this. So I'm not sure. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm willing to concede. I'm not sure if her campaign promises were, I'm gonna go to Congress and I'm gonna protect this president by any means necessary.
It might have been.
If anybody has anything of concrete evidence on this president, or who might testify against the veracity of this president and his lies,
yeah,
I'm gonna defend him wholeheartedly without any real recourse or any real evidence to support my defense.
It looks like that.
Is that what they sent you to Congress to do?
For 32% of the country, yes, that is what they sent him for. One of the most embarrassing things to happen at this testimony from the point of view of Donald Trump was the revelation by Michael Cohen of how the efforts they went to make sure that you never found out what a horrible student he was, as you'll see.
When I say con man, I'm talking about a man who declares himself brilliant, but directed me to threaten his high school, his colleges, and the college board to never release his grades or SAT scores. As I mentioned, I'm giving the committee today copies of a letter I sent at Mr. Trump's direction, threatening these schools with civil and criminal actions if Mr. Trump's grades or SAT scores were ever disclosed without his permission. The irony wasn't lost on me at the time that Mr. Trump, in 2011, had strongly criticized President Obama for not releasing his grades.
The irony was not lost on me either. And again, this is reminder number 10,243 that Donald Trump is just projection. Projection and fillets au fish. That is all that he is. And so how could Barack Obama have seriously gotten these grades and these degrees when I know how hard college is because I failed through it the whole time?
You know what? If I'm defending the president, if I'm a Republican and I think Michael Cohen is a liar and I want to shred his credibility, and they've gone with his, you know, his bank thing and his fraud and all that stuff, whatever it is he's done, he's lied about and he's going to prison over. You know what you can do by tomorrow? Go to those schools. Mm-hmm. Get the information directly from these schools and say, is it a lie that they bullied you into not ever releasing any records from the president? And then you can check that. Hey, let's tear up his credibility right now. Come back tomorrow and tell me all the evidence you have against these statements he's had about making sure the schools don't release any of this information, any of the test scores, any of that. And you give a direct today discredit of his testimony.
Yeah.
Will that come?
I don't think they're going to do that.
Because if I really believed it, I would go after that.
It's the most plausible thing in the world. So, and by the way, we have the letter. It's just paragraph after paragraph. Here's how you're going to get fined. You're going to get thrown in jail. By the way, the last line is a P.S. Donald Trump has a great deal of respect for Fordham and enjoyed his years there. After threatening to throw them in jail if they ever reveal what a mediocre student he was. And now, it's right up there with the tax returns. I want to see the transcripts. Mm-hmm. Show me the transcripts.
Show us all of
Show
it.
Me the transcripts.
If he's but a perfect it's guy, it's easy to see it, isn't it? Show us.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll show you mine. You show me yours. With that, thank you so much for joining me. Big day still planned with coverage of the Cohen testimony, so buckle up. There's a lot more where that came from. We've got an awesome rest of the week planned, including another documentarian who did a documentary on saving migrants in the Mediterranean Ocean coming up later this week. We'll see you then. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.